Well, I apologize to the audience and to any members here on bill hearings, but I think half of our committee are the Republicans at a caucus called right after session, and I see some of my members are trickling in, so we'll just start House File 3569. I can't call the meeting to order. I don't have a quorum. I can't move the bill, so I'll just have Dr. Finnegan from the university come up, I guess, and start with testimony regarding the need for this and what's been happening so far, and then what will happen with the appropriations should the governor approve it. And Dr. Finnegan and Mandel, welcome to the committee. And you should probably state your name just for the case. Just so we got you on record in case, you know, we have to.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Finnegan. I'm Dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota and also Assistant Vice President for Public Health at the university.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jeff Mandel. I'm one of the faculty members in the School of Public Health.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. And Dr. Finnegan, if you want to start then.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman, members of the committee. We became involved in situation regarding the lung health of taconite workers and miners on the Iron Range earlier this spring, directly involved as a result of the release of data, or the late release of data, by the previous Commissioner of Health. At that time, legislators contacted the president of the university, Bob Brunick, who then contacted myself and Dr. Frank Serra, who is the senior vice president of the Academic Health Center, asking for our assistance and willingness to work conjointly with the Minnesota Department of Health to get to the bottom of the lung health situation. And to refresh your memory briefly, 58 cases of mesothelioma were discovered in the data that the health department had analyzed. We can talk about that in detail later. But these cases were clearly in excess of the types of cases that one would normally expect to see in an average type population, raising strong concerns because these folks work in the mining industry or in mining-related roles. We became involved beginning in June directly and met with members of the range delegation as well as members of the community at the Mountain Iron Community Center and heard concerns expressed and also a clear request for the university to become involved with this, which we did. The president of the university put forward some funds from the university, and the director of the Natural Resources Research Institute at UMD also put together some initial funding, and we began the process of responding to the issue of taconite workers' lung health on the Iron Range. And what we did at that time was to form the Minnesota Taconite Workers Lung Health Partnership. And that is a partnership that includes the leadership of the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Health, and in collaboration and in partnership with the members and communities on the Iron Range. And if you explore our website, which is attached to the School of Public Health website, we have an URL, an address for you to look at if you would choose to do so. You will see that there are more than two dozen community partners that have joined us in this. I might add that that ranges from members of the iron mining industry on the range, as well as the health care providers, as well as the unions, and various groups of workers, and other interested groups such as retired iron miners and so forth. That taconite worker lung health partnership has had its first meeting last August and a second meeting in mid-December. And at both of those meetings, we laid out for the community at a public meeting what we believed would be the basic science needed to get to the bottom of the questions that were raised by the mesothelioma data, how we would go about doing that, and the progress that we had made to date. So the meeting that we held on December 17th then, we used to outline in general the types of studies that we believe would be necessary to get this work done. So that's a general overview of where we are, and our contacts have continued with the state legislature. We have continued to build a very strong working relationship with Commissioner Stanny Magnin and the members of the Minnesota Department of Health to move this effort forward. And so we are here to talk with you about House File 3569, which proposes $4.9 million to pursue the research that we have outlined, and we'd be happy to provide details for you.
Thank you, Dr. Finnegan. I think we'll just have Dr. Mandel then go forward, and maybe if you can break down the $4.9 million, which I think you might do that in part of your handout here. I'm not sure if you do that or not, Dr. Mandel, but if you would like to just go ahead and start, and maybe you can give us a kind of a somewhat brief outline of where all the money's going.
Okay.
And what, you know, is being studied in each different part of that appropriation.
Right. Maybe I should preface some of the numbers by giving you a sense of how we decided to organize this effort. Starting again back in June or so, we decided that because of the complexity of this issue that we would need to form what we call a multidisciplinary team to address this in the way that in the best way that we could. And so we formed a study group made up of scientists from within the School of Public Health primarily, but also including people in the health department and representing multiple disciplines, including epidemiology and occupational medicine, industrial hygiene, and also we've included people from the medical school and the pulmonary division. So that's sort of our focal team. And in addition, this group has had expert guidance from an external science advisory group that we put together, realizing that there are some controversial issues where we could use additional assistance. And so we were able to pull into the process four of the very prominent scientists, again, representing the same disciplines that I mentioned a little while ago. And out of that, we determined that there were three key issues that seemed to be necessary to address. Those are listed in the materials that we forward to Representative Rucanina. But just to reiterate those, the first thing on our agenda was to try to figure out what's responsible for the 58 cases of mesothelioma. That seemed to be the first priority. The second priority was whether we could also, in the process of this work, identify whether taconite workers would have other conditions that we may not be aware of currently. So that involves what we call a cause of death study. And it would include anyone who's worked in the taconite industry going back to its inception in the 1950s and extending into the 1980s. That's the cohort that we are dealing with. And then the last thing that we decided was necessary was to try to get a handle on whether there are diseases that don't show up in the state's disease registry, the cancer registry, or the cause of death registry that might be important to know about in assessing this issue. And to do that, we thought that the best approach would be to screen current and former workers and their spouses. And their spouses are sort of an interesting group for us to consider, because we know there are concerns in the community, up on the Iron Range, as far as whether exposures to dust in the non-working public might have some harmful effects. So spouses are in the non-working community. They also have exposure from general environmental exposures. So we thought that that would be our best chance to try to determine whether the communities had some potential risk from taconite operations. So with that sort of backdrop, we designed four studies, and those studies were also to be complemented by some additional work involving community sampling, which was to be undertaken by the Natural Resource Research Institute. And the total amount of the 4.9 million, of that 4.9 million, 4.1 million have to do with the health studies, which I'll mention a little bit, in a little bit. And about 800,000 those were dollars that were tied into the community sampling. So 4.1 million, those are the costs for the human health studies. And those consist of the cause of death study, the study looking at factors associated with mesothelioma, and the screening studies. And then one final study, which is an exposure assessment, which I didn't mention, but is a way of getting a sense of how much dust exposures there have been in the work operations throughout the taconite industries. Those four studies together comprise 4.1 million. And I can break those down further. The cause of death study and the mesothelioma factors involved with mesothelioma, those amount to about, I think, 1.6 million in total. The screening study is in the range of 1.5 million. And the balance of the 4.1 then is the exposure assessment. So those are sort of the numbers that make up that 4.1 million.
And is your timeline, Doctor, still, are you on time yet, or where you hope to be at this point, and then you think it's a three and a half year total?
Well, we're pretty much on time. We've done a lot of the preliminary work trying to understand some of the exposure issues in more detail. We've been in contact with some of the key companies that we know have to be involved so that we can learn more about exposures. The companies have that, largely have that information. And so I think, you know, that's the part that we've done right now. And we're set to go in terms of finding out, updating the information on exposure. We need to know a lot more information on exposure. We also need to find out what the causes of death are in the cohort, which is a large cohort, amounts to over 70,000 people. And then once we have that information, we can start looking at the factors that are associated with mesothelioma, what the risk factors might be associated with mesothelioma.
I think at this time, before I move on, I was going to call Mr. Olson from the United Steelworkers, but Dr. Finnegan, do you know the numbers as far as what the university, both at the NRI and down here, has expended so far on your things that you've been doing? For the committee's information, the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board approved $250,000 to help Dr. Mandel jumpstart some things that had to be done, I believe, with the medical stuff up north. But Dr. Finnegan, do you know what kind of a number we have as far as between NRIs and the university's contributions?
Right, I think it's about $500,000 total. It's about $200,000, I think, from the president, Bob Runick, and I think it's about $300,000 that comes through the NRRI for some of the initial field work that they've been doing. So it's about $500,000, is my understanding.
Okay. Representative Gossett. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My stepdad has mesothelioma, whatever that word is, And he's a plumber. And we could identify what the sources were that he made them in. And we could go after that company. Taconite mining is naturally in the ore, is that correct?
There is naturally occurring, let me preface my comment by saying that mesothelioma is a disease that's almost exclusively caused by asbestos exposure. And there is naturally occurring asbestos fiber in some portions of the Iron Range, primarily on the eastern end of the range. So it is possible that through the process of the mining industry, removing the ore and processing it, there's theoretically the chance that exposure to some of those asbestos fibers could occur. And that's one of the things that we'd be interested in looking at in more detail to see if that might be behind these cases. It's also possible that these cases might originate from other types of exposure to asbestos, such as commercial use of asbestos, as plumbers often may have that type of exposure. Or there may be exposures to asbestos in other settings that are completely disparate from the Iron Age. It might be that somebody was in the Navy on board a ship that had a lot of asbestos on it. So there are a lot of different reasons why people could have exposure to asbestos. And that's the point of doing these investigations, to find out more about that.
Representative Dr. Point of a little historical perspective on this. Back in the 80s, the early 80s, late 70s, you know, there were the rumors because of the Silver Bay and the asbestos-like fibers with the big court case and Judge Lord and everything else. So IRRB had paid for some a study back then. A quick study, university did it. I think records were lost because of a flood, but there was this group of miners' names that was out there that I think that you people have recovered. Then we had the study done in the late 90s. That study got canceled because of the financial budget crisis under the Ventura administration, and that study showed that there was a high rate of, you know, mesothelioma on the range, but it basically, the people they studied had been exposed to, as Dr. Mandel said, maybe one was a boiler maker in the Navy and a couple of them worked at the Conway plant in Duluth where they got exposed to asbestos, but the study never really got completed, and then this 56 number jumped out at us. And so what we're trying to do is get to the bottom of this once and for all, because we started the study and never stopped. And I'm comfortable with the university doing this. They've got a very good, both the university, the Twin Cities part of the study here that's being conducted down here, they have an advisory group of, I think, the brightest and best, and just like these two at the table, you know, but that from around the country. The NRI in Duluth for their airborne study of that, and a plant dust study that they're going to be doing, also has an advisory group of people from, like, I think the director of the National Institute of Occupational Health from Cincinnati regional offices on it, along with others. So trying to do this right once and for all to get to the bottom of it. And so if you have another question.
I just have a comment. Basically, it would be nice for every individual case to find out where they got exposure to asbestos. I know my brother Bill was a boiler tender, and he has an 80% disability from the Navy. That certainly helps out his family. And my stepdad, who was an ex-professional athlete and was a plumber, and he said you could barely see the light sometimes with the asbestos all over where he was working. They knew what companies had asbestos, and they could go after those companies, and he's being remunerated fairly well because of that. But it would be nice for those people's sakes if we could find out exactly where it was from.
And with that, maybe Mr. Olson, you could come down and give the university's perspective, and then we'll open up questions for the doctors, the steel workers. Did I say what? Or excuse me, steel worker perspective. My constituent, welcome to the committee, Mr. Olson. He lives north of Chisholm, north of Tony's hometown. He hangs around with Thomasoni and Certis, and not me, but he's my constituent. And He's still mad that I haven't given him the Township Road update that I promised some years ago, but his wife, I think.
You promised my wife that.
Yes. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Olson.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for calling me, Mr. Olson. My name is Charlie Olson, and I'm a third generation steelworker. I've been a steelworker working in a mine for 38 years. I'm here today to ask you to help the workers in northern Minnesota, our taconite workers and our members, and there's thousands of them that are workers and retirees. But I guess I'm asking you to fund this study, not for me, because I'm ending my career. Hopefully I'll be able to retire in a couple of years, but for the new miners who are just starting, and there's a big job turnover on the range. So we're getting a lot of new miners that are coming in, and if this is a hazard to them, hopefully we can find out why and repair it. You know, this is, mesothelioma is a deadly disease, and it takes 30 years or more. You know, it takes a long time for it to come out. If I have it, you know, this is probably when I'll get it. Maybe I'm going to be 61 this month. You know, the next 5 or 10 years, I'd like to live to be 85 and then vote for Representative Rukavina into the future. So, I worked at Hibbing Taconite for many years. I was under the assumption.
With that, we have a quorum, so I'll call a meeting to order. Thank you.
I was always under the assumption when I started working in the mines, I worked at Mintac for 5 years, and then when Hibbing Taconite opened, I worked there, and I'm still there. But I was always under the assumption that the east end of the range, the taconite was a different kind, and I don't remember if it was harder or softer or whatever. And the guys like me that worked on the east end or on the west end, we didn't have to worry so much about the mesothelioma. But now, my understanding is that we have cases in every one of the mines. And I don't know, you know, if they're caused from the mine or for the different types of taconite or what's going on. So, like the gentleman said ahead of me, you know, our Representative Rukavina said that there's been a study, a couple of studies that were gone on before us. They were never completed for lack of funding or for whatever. We must keep the study complete. You know, we need to complete it now. You can't fund this partway and say we'll fund it again later. The miners deserve an answer. We need to know, how do we protect ourselves, or what should we do so that the new guys don't get mesothelioma. You know, when I go home from work, if I take a shower, I still bring dust home with me. My wife and my kids, all my kids are grown, and I hope they're fine. But I, you know, when you come home from the mine, you bring all that dust and dirt with you. I remember my wife, when I worked at Mintac, I worked in an agglomerator and was really dirty, and she always said, "I can tell where you lay in the bed because the dirt goes right through. It goes through the sheet, through the liner, right into the mattress." So you bring all that dirt home with you every day, and you can shower every day, and you bring that dust home. And we need to complete this study so we can find out why we're getting it, or why it's caused, how it's caused, and how we can prevent this from happening again. So, thank you. Any questions?
Questions of Mr. Olson? Not then. Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Doctors Finnegan and Mandel, questions for the doctors, Representative Clark.
Well,
Representative Anzos, when I come and sit at the table, I have to tell my colleagues that Representative Anzos was very instrumental in saying that this study had to be done. So I want you to come up and sit right with me if you want, Representative Anzos. But if you'd like to say anything, you're welcome to, too. Go ahead, Representative Clark.
Thank you. My question is one that takes off right where Mr. Olson, Charlie Olson, where you left off with your testimony. Part of the commitment on the study, I believe, is to study the families and the impact on families. And I didn't quite hear that in your presentation earlier. I did hear you talk about a community, what did you call it, community sampling. I guess I'd like to be interested in a little more details about what we're doing to look at the families. I know when we were talking earlier, I really earlier when you were designing the study, standing with representatives of the community and some and others, and we talked about the importance of trying to understand what the take-home desk does to a family, potentially, and everything, you know, at vulnerable, especially at vulnerable ages, and I'm and at vulnerable parts of life during pregnancy, when kids are little. So can you describe to me what it is, I don't know which one of you wants to do this, what it is that you've actually put in place or plan to put in place so that Mr. Olson can get answers to his questions?
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that. As part of the screening, respiratory health screening study, which is where we are looking at current and former minors and their spouses, we are designing a questionnaire that will include a fairly detailed family history. And through that information, we'll take, we'll find out about what illnesses children or any family members have had. That information will be looked at in a separate sort of assessment, just looking at the numbers. And that's primarily the mechanism that we've designed to address the family health issues, along with the spousal screening itself. Now, spouses will be examined again with history and physicals, and they'll undergo the same screening test that the minors will undergo, including chest x-rays, pulmonary function tests, and possibly more detailed tests, depending on how their screening studies look. They could, for example, end up getting additional tests like a CAT scan if their chest x-ray is controversial or what have you. So to answer your question, it's primarily through the medical history that we're going to learn more about children and other members of the family.
And Mr. Chairman, Clark, are you doing this sort of history and possible exams on which people?
We'll be selecting 2,000 approximately people. That includes about 1,200 current and former workers and about 800 spouses. We'll be selecting those depending on where they live and how much time they had in the industry. We'll have what we call a stratified sampling process where we can look at all these different categories of potential involvement with mining exposure.
Mr. Kennedy, yep. Will you be including in this survey the surviving spouses and children of the deceased?
Mr. Mandel, Dr. Mandel, go ahead.
Well, that's a detail that we haven't gotten down to. Reason why we wouldn't want to do that. I'm just not sure about the detail of information that we'll have that we use to actually determine who gets screened. But is that an issue?
You're talking about a sub-study of the 58 of the families of the 58 deceased.
Yeah, I'm just curious why you're asking about that.
Well, I'll tell you why. When we were up at the hearing, one of the people I remember who came forward and talked about her husband dying, I believe I believe it was her or her friend who had breast cancer, and I believe there were several people who talked about kinds of cancers that the women were getting, and they wanted to know, was there any relationship, and no one could answer, of course, because the study's never been done.
Right.
And so I think that was one of the questions that where I thought they deserve an answer. And I would think, you know, children would also be, those little cells that are dividing, especially at a very young age or during pregnancy, those would be if you want to look at birth defects and so on. I noticed,
Clark, if I could just for a second, I've sat down with this group several times and with the NRI folks, and, you know, this a lot of people think $4.9 million is a lot of money. It still is where I come from, and it allows them and enables them to get going. I think the bottom line, the main questions we have to ask is, and one of the first things we want to try to get to is it the or?
What's causing this? That's what the NRI is going to be looking at. They're going to be looking at, is that what happened here with these groups, from what I understand? And they're bringing in the families, too. And am I also understanding, Dr. Finnegan, correct me if I'm wrong, is that we're looking at other diseases besides mesothelioma that may be caused, you know, included in families that whose spouse may have died. But I don't know how deep you can get into other diseases besides, you know, lung-related, and I don't know, maybe that's part of what you're going to be looking at.
Well, I think, as Dr. Mandel explained, I think that the primary focus is obviously on the workers and the spouses. The spouse's exposure, of course, being indirect, and that then gets to some of what Representative Clark's concerns are about families. So the studies are primarily designed to focus on worker health and then the spouses. However, I think that given a number of the instruments that we are talking about, we're certainly going to get information out of those things that would suggest, if we find it, that there may be broader involvement of other members of, say, a minor's family than only the worker itself. If we do see that, then that's obviously going to indicate the need for some additional work as well.
Will your cohorts involved with, say, that you discover a number of pancreatic cancers, or just as an example, or breast cancers or anything, will that jump out at you and you know, be then caused for maybe another study that's going to cost more money, or could it be in this study also?
Well, those are very good questions, and I think they get to the issue of this cause of death study, which looks at 70 or 80 different causes of death, cancer and heart disease and diseases of the endocrine system and anything that leads to death. So if something shows up as in an excess, because the way we do those studies is we look at the observed cases and we compare them to what's expected based on age and gender. If something pops up, then we have the opportunity of looking at that disease by exposure categories, and that's the utility of doing the exposure assessment. So if pancreatic cancer showed up in excess and it was strongly related to taconite exposure or breast cancer or whatever the cancer or the disease might be, we'll have the advantage of understanding that in relationship to the taconite exposures. And that would be a very important insight. And if there is a relationship that does appear to be related to work exposure somehow or other, then that would be the ground for doing additional investigation. And that would be beyond the scope of this particular study. But at least this will get us on the map.
Representative Clark, then, any other?
Well, I guess I'm just interested if they're going to keep a database, because one of the qualifiers you had in your answer just now was if you can show that it's finally related to taconite exposure. Well, the only way you would know is if over a period of time you started to see a pattern, and then you might ask the question. So I guess I would be interested if you're planning to keep a database, no matter whether you see right away, you know, or have a thesis that there is a relationship. I mean, if you're keeping a database, you might be able to start observing patterns. If you don't keep the database, you'll never see a pattern.
Yeah, we will be keeping the database.
Thank you. Since I got a quorum finally, I'll move House File Number 3569 to recommend it to pass. And Representative Clark, you want to see this with the Department of Health and your committee and refer to the Finance, Health and
Housing Finance
Division. And then, members, I've got an amendment that's being passed out, and I'm going to move the amendment. Since I moved the bill, I'll move the amendment A1, and what the amendment does is basically takes the appropriation, since there will be no general fund money to work with this year, out of the Workers' Compensation Special Fund. So that's my amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, any other questions on the amendment itself then? Mr. Rakowski, are you in the audience? Huh? Okay, and Representative Hortman then, and Norton, Representative Hortman first for the doctors.
No,
Mr. Chair, not to him, I mentioned not to the doctors, but I just wondered, I'm sorry I wasn't here at the beginning of the hearing, if you reminded the committee about the hearings we had in Mountain Lake?
Mountain Iron.
It was pretty up there, so. And if you talked, made reference to all the people from the communities, the affected communities that came to those hearings, I really appreciated that you had those hearings and that they were, the one hearing that I went to in Mountain Iron, and that it was there so that people could come and tell us personally how they felt about this, and that you guys came up with this proposal. Because I know for your constituents to come down here and tell us, but I don't know that all the members of the committee were able to be there. There was a lot of emotion in that room. And
I thought for Rangers to handle themselves pretty good, too.
There was a lot of really good testimony from people who worked in the mines and the family members and people who had family members that were working in them now. And I wouldn't want their voices that they brought to us up in Mountain Iron to be lost when we're talking about this today, because I think seeing that, if anybody who was there that day and heard what we heard that day would find money wherever we have to find money to fund this study.
Well, I appreciate that, Representative Hartman, and I think Mr. Olson reiterated what the main theme of that group was. Old Mr. Joe Scholar, who's been saying for years about this, that there's a high rate of mesothelioma, and people really didn't, you know, listen to him. But the theme was, as Mr. Olson reiterated, you know, we can't do anything for most of us in this room, because if we've got it, we've got it. It's done. But for the young people starting off, hopefully we can do something. And that not only is this part of this study, but the part of the dust and airborne stuff that the NRI is doing in conjunction with them. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As some of you know, I've spent some time studying the issue of radon, and I know that some of the very early studies about radon were done in the mines that we're talking about and in that area. And so I do know there's already been a proven correlation between working in the mines and the exposure to radon. And so I guess I'm wondering if you're going to look at what sort of correlation there is as to whether radon is involved in a precursor to mesothelioma. So I just want to raise that issue, because I know radon has been identified for many, many years as a concern for miners. Secondly, according to some folks I talked to at Mayo, in order to determine whether the cause of death is really mesothelioma compared to a radon-caused lung cancer or some other form of lung cancer, not, and I'm not saying one is less or more important than the other, but in order to know if it's really mesothelioma, a biopsy is needed. And so I'm wondering, as you're studying past cases, and hopefully you will continue to study the cases that are newly identified, that you can get those biopsies done so you really can pinpoint what the cause is, and if there are multiple causes, that should be identified too. And then, having said that, I guess I would disagree with the chair in that we know that being in mines causes lung problems, whether asbestos or radon or mesothelioma. We know that that there's a correlation. It's finding out what the cause, you know, what specifically the cause is, and is there something we can do to mitigate it, save closing mines and not letting people work there. So I think, to me, that's the bottom line, is getting at what exactly is causing it, what can we do to stop that causation so that we can continue with an industry that's important for your area.
Doctor Finnegan, maybe, or whichever doctor wants to handle that.
I'll take a shot at it. First of all, the radon issue. Radon is a known cause of lung cancer. To my knowledge, it is not a factor in mesothelioma, but it's an important consideration. And we'll look at radon in the context of doing these studies. Of course, that will depend on the type of exposure information that the companies have gathered on it. I suspect that they have a lot of information on it, and that information will be incorporated into our studies. In terms of the identification of mesothelioma cases, the way that the current state cancer tumor registry operates is that it requires information from all the pathology labs in the state to submit tissue examined information to the registry. So the basis of the current cases of mesothelioma is a tissue analysis done by a pathologist. And so that's one advantage in being able to utilize the cancer surveillance system here in Minnesota, that it has a very robust process of identifying these tumors accurately.
So that would take us, Representative, that would take us going forward, but many older cases, if you will, of mesothelioma, we may not have that kind of tissue availability.
And Mr. Chair, that was Mayo's comment, is that he thought, I talked to two doctors, they thought it might be a little premature to blame them all on mesothelioma, where it could be something else if you don't have the biopsy. And so I'm very pleased to hear that moving forward you will be using biopsy and tissue. Thank you.
Yeah, and the existing information on tissue goes back to 1988.
Any comments? Is there anyone here from the Department of Health that would like to comment on it? No comments. I'm just curious if you would, ma'am. Last year when this whole issue was presented, welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself for the case.
Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health.
Thank you. Welcome. Last year, if you recall, at the time the commissioner, then Commissioner Mananock, had talked about, and Dr. Fender, about federal dollars for this. Has any applications been made for federal dollars at the Department of Health?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we did make one federal application and we did not receive those funds. And we continue to look to see if there are additional opportunities for that. But at this time, I believe we're just pursuing one opportunity, and I'm not certain of the funding amount, and I'm not certain either if it would fund any of the specific studies that have been identified today. But I can get that confirmed for you and get that back to you.
Did you ask, like, Senator Coleman or Senator Klobuchar or any of the Minnesota delegation here at Hill?
Mr. Chair, I would have to get back to you on that to see what conversation that Commissioner
has. I appreciate it, because I've since been in touch with Senator Klobuchar's and Representative Overstar's office, and I believe they got in touch with one of you, and they're trying to do something. And I will say to the members, if any money is contributed to this from NIOSH or whoever's budget, that we will then reduce the appropriation, the state appropriation accordingly. So, thank you very much. Any questions of the Department of Health? Representative Clark.
I can't ask Kelly go without, asking. Since this was actually one of the issues that caused us to try to make the cancer registry a little more responsive in terms of collecting information on occupation, can you tell me the status of the cancer registry's attention to occupational exposures now? I mean, we did talk about saying you should make at least a line in space for occupational and residential history, but has it started to happen? And if so, is it just what happens to be available, which I think was the understanding explained to me, rather than are we actually collecting information? So, for example, the way that this relates to this question is, so many people who had mesothelioma before and are not maybe identified among the 58, are we ever going to find them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, as you stated, the line in space, we've done that update to our registry so that if information is reported to us, we can include it in our registry. And we are pursuing opening the rules so that we can adjust the rules to require that occupational and residential history be reported to the department. And that process is beginning.
Thank you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a little bit of a follow-up, I think, sort of to what you were talking about, Mr. Chair. What would happen if you don't get any money from the state, federal government, or whatever? What happens to the status of this study?
I imagine it doesn't happen.
Well, it's not likely to happen. It's possible that federal funds could be solicited, but the way the federal system works, it's a lot more risky in the sense that it takes a longer period of time. It's a competitive system, and I just don't know how this particular issue would be regarded at the national level. We would submit a grant, in that case, to one of the federal institutions, and they have their own research agendas, and so I'm not sure how this would fit into their agendas. So I think it's safe to say it would be less that much less likely to receive funding.
Representative, assuming that money was available, say from NIOSH or one of the other federal agencies, you could count on at least a one-year process from writing the application through peer review and then learning what your score is, whether it would be funded. So it would be a substantial delay in the ability to do the research should the funding not be forthcoming here.
Just a follow-up to that then, what amount of data is lost and or with an interruption like that? How damaging is that to your study?
Well, it's not damaging to the study itself because we can always pick up that information, at that point in time in the future. I think the damaging part of this is more on the community level, where the anxiety levels will certainly be affected by this. I think there's some optimism within the communities based on our dialogue with those folks, and some hope now, and that's coming down the road in the form of this study. They want to see some closure to this issue. So I think that's the potential danger.
I think that's really an important point, because the data systems that are in place through the health department and with this cohort of minors, will continue to record the deaths. But if the goal is to reduce that and to get towards the era of prevention and so forth, then clearly a delay is not in anyone's interest. Mr.
Chair, I think I mentioned last year in this committee that my mother passed away from the same form of cancer, and obviously it didn't work in the mind. A friend of mine just passed away yesterday from throat cancer, and I know a neighbor that also suffered. There's cancer all over the state. My question, I guess, is, and I support what you're doing here, but my question of the department maybe would be, is there other studies that are ongoing? I mean, I'm all for finding cure, but it seems to me so far all we have is a lot of good theories and suspicions. So I'm wondering if other things are going on across the state that might help someday to find out what causes. Again, I know four people right now that have, counting the one that just died, that have throat cancer.
Representative Nornis, before you came in the room, we talked about the history of it and the studies that were started back in the late 70s on this particular issue and never completed. That's the study that was done in the late 90s, and then when the budget crisis hit during the Ventura administration, never completed. And then the fact that the whole thing blew up when we had a presentation in this committee, a joint presentation with Representative Clark's committee, and we found out there were 56 new cases. I think at the time the number was a little smaller. And the commissioner and Dr. Bender sat by at that table there and said that they were going to make some applications to federal grants. And this is a crisis. The numbers were much, much, much higher than they should be in a normal population. And then, of course, we found out that this information had been known for a year and a half before they came and told us. And so this issue has been around a long time, and it's just in a specific geographic area. On this bill, I wanted to do something with what's happened now in Representative Poppy's district with the swine disease that's affecting people that jumped from, the butchering facility down there and made a number of her constituents sick. And the Department of Health, I think, has that obligation. And you heard up in Mountain Iron, I can't remember if you were there, Representative Stevenson was there, and Representative Portman talked about it, Representative Clark. Our community across the range was not, because of the fact that this was sat on for almost a year and a half, was not confident with the Department of Health doing this study. So we engaged the university to be the lead on it with the cooperation of the Department of Health. And so there are occupational diseases that I think our Department of Health has to really have special appropriation, and maybe what's happening in the rest of them Poppy's district is one of that warrants that. But this particular mesothelioma issue, we've got to get to the bottom of it once and for all, because Representative Norton, there's a lot of building going on in Rochester, and if you have your way in the bonding bill, there'll be a lot more. So, but you can't build buildings without steel, and you can't build buildings without copper and a lot of other things that are needed, and somebody's got to mine it somewhere, and
I guess, fortunate enough and cursed enough to have those minerals in this state. And we got to, part of this study is looking at, is there a problem? Is it the ore? If it is the ore, what can we do for dust control? All of that stuff is going to be looked at in here. It's a comprehensive study, Representative Norness, that we hope to get to the bottom of once and for all. And so I guess I don't have any argument with what you're saying, that cancers occur all around this state. And I think the Department of Health looks at those cancers. And because of Representative Clark's consistency over the years, they're now recording those cancers. And so I guess that's another issue for another day, and Representative Poppy's issue is another issue for another day, although I think the university brought someone who was involved in doing some cooperative things with the Department of Health currently on that swine issue known as the Hormel plant, or the plant next to the Hormel plant. But that's where we're at today, and that's why we're here. And the governor, you have a letter in the packet from the governor who has promised this full cooperation after what happened in June of last year happened. And so that's where we're at the point right now. And I think I found a good source for the funding. We've made the promise that if federal funding is available, we'll deduct the special comp funds off of here. And I guess with that, are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair, can I have the department respond? I think they came down.
Sure, Department of Health, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do collect information on cancer throughout the state. Our Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System is a database of every cancer occurrence in the state or diagnosis in the state. And we do look at that database to see if there are anomalies, to see if there are clusters of cancer that warrant further investigation. And that is what led us to looking at these cases of mesothelioma.
Okay, no further questions. Then Representative Clark, you really have to see this bill, huh?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And you will get it expedited and onto the floor.
Okay.
That's right. Okay, Representative, and then I'll renew my motion that House Bill 3569 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to Representative Clark's committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Winkler. And then, is Representative Kohlberg here? No, if somebody wants to go get Representative one of the pages, get Representative Kohlberg too then. Representative Winkler, welcome to the committee, and Representative Welty moved House File 3143 be recommended to pass and referred to taxes. Is that right?
That's right.
Welcome to the committee, Wink. How you doing?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you had something against me in scheduling me after mesothelioma today and after Job Z yesterday. But
well, no, not at all.
You did eventually get to the bill, so
yes.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members, if you step back and consider, I think the most important issue that we as a legislature should address this session and in future sessions is the fact that for the first time in a generation, Minnesota's economy is not only not doing well, but it's behind the rest of the country. In job growth and personal income, Minnesota is slipping behind the rest of the nation for the first time, certainly in my memory. I guess I sort of took a logical question, which was, if the economy is slipping behind the rest of the country, why do the economists think that is? And one of the issues that they have highlighted is the fact that Minnesota is not doing well in the startup technology sector. The state economist, Tom Stinson, has identified, and your committee heard testimony, I think, from him in a joint hearing prior to session about this very fact. The quote I have from the Minnesota Post publication from him is that the identification of new products and new processes and new ways of doing things has slumped significantly in Minnesota compared to what it was 20 to 30 years ago. That is part of our underperformance economically because we've not been investing in research and development. The bill that I have before you is part of several bills that I'm carrying this session to try to put more money into the early stage technology sector of the economy. From 1995 going forward, Minnesota has had about 1.5% of the total venture capital and angel capital investment dollars in this country. From 2004 forward, however, we've gone down to only 1.2%, and the vast majority of the money that we do have flowing in is in the medical device sector of the economy. And what's happening is that as the economy is shifting, we do not have enough new technology companies coming up through the base level of our economy to shift and help us be an agile economy as a state. So the bill that I have that you're seeing today is actually very similar or almost exactly the same to a bill that Representative Dabney carried last year. It was in the tax bill last year. The difference is primarily that in the tax bill last year, it's a $3 million total tax credit, but the $3 million, obviously, in a budget deficit situation, would come out of the rest of the state's revenue and would put us further into a deficit. And so, therefore, the funding source, at least for the first year of this tax credit, is from the Department of Economic Development, essentially. And the idea is that we could be putting money into a sector of the economy that economists say is important rather than putting it into an agency. I would just note that when Wisconsin passed a very similar provision in 2004, the first year of that tax credit saw a 54% increase in the amount of money flowing into startup company funds.
So what dollar amount was that represented?
$3 million, Mr. Chair.
No, but I mean in the investment part.
I have to look through my paperwork to get to that. I think it's the tax credit total was $20 million, and I think that's a 25% credit for the total investment, so it would have leveraged about $100
million. $125 million, okay.
So the bill basically is, I don't think this committee has heard it before, but an investor can put take a credit against 25% of their investment in a qualified business up to $25,000. So essentially this allows for a $100,000 investment into a new technology company. You have to be an accredited investor, meaning that you have high net worth or high income so that you're not taking a risk with money that you can't afford to take. There's a 10-year total carryover for the credit, and there's a definition of what the types of qualifying businesses are, but it's basically the high-tech sector. The headquarters of the business have to be in Minnesota. 51% of the employees have to be in Minnesota, have to be fewer than 25 employees. You have to have less than $1 million in gross sales. And you have to have a total private investment of less than $2 million. And what that really does is target the very early stage companies that are really where the economy is, or where the capital market is not producing in Minnesota. We do pretty well in deals that are $5 million or above, but less than $5 million in Minnesota right now is not doing very well. And so that is the essence of the bill. It's a previous bill that it was passed and was in the tax bill, but it has the funding for it.
Okay, thank you very much. I have a question, Ms. Novak or Mr. Berg. In the overview, we see that there's a reduction in deeds appropriation by $3 million, but I don't see it anywhere in the bill. It's a credit given by deed of up to $3 million. So could you tell me?
Mr. Chair, it's on section 2 of the very last section of the bill.
Okay. And Representative Winkler, you're letting that be an overall reduction by the commissioner then?
Yes.
You're not taking out a specific part.
No.
Well, with that, and this bill probably should have went to taxes first and then ended up here since I'm paying the bill on it. So what I'll do, and if there are questions, we'll take them, but I'm going to we'll make the motion then, Representative Welty, to re-refer it to taxes, but then when you leave taxes, you got to come back here. Representative Lincheski will re-refer it back here.
Okay.
For a possible inclusion in our final bill.
Okay.
So we're not going to let you spend our money without having a final say in that.
I'm
is that okay with you?
I'm by that, Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
Yes, please.
Representative Clark and then Hartman.
Thank you. Could you go over again? I think you said $100,000. We think $100,000 investment there. There's a $25,000 tax credit available to that investor?
Yes.
Can we talk a little bit about which amounts then to a subsidy? Whenever we're talking about subsidies to businesses that do research and so on, I'm always interested in what the return to the consumer is. And I noticed one of the groups you have here are drug companies or drug delivery. I don't quite know what that means. But what does drug delivery mean, first of all?
Madam Chair, Representative Park, I actually don't know the specific definition of drug delivery, but the idea is that we're talking primarily about the bioscience industry. So that would tend to be, we don't have much of a biopharma or a pharmaceutical industry in the state of Minnesota. We're mostly in the, we're very strong in medical devices, but it's the cluster of businesses that are involved in essentially the bioscience part of the economy.
Mr. Chairman, whether that's a big part or not, I see it's included, and I know drug prices are pretty high, so it's just an example of, I guess, where I'm interested, whether we're talking about medical devices, drugs being produced, various kinds of technology that might help people with green manufacturing, all of those things, some of them which seem something we'd really want to support. I'm interested what kind of accountability we get for our tax subsidy. In other words, the chairman knows I've put an amendment on some of the other bioscience language that when we do this kind of public subsidy to these sciences as we do to other kinds of manufacturing, we want to know that it benefits the consumer. And so just to report what the benefit is, are we talking about lowered, more affordable drug prices or more affordable green manufacturing processes or more affordable alternative energy products? Do you understand my question? Somehow to account for that, and I'm wondering if you'd be open to looking at some language that would help us track that.
Well, Representative Winkler, when this bill gets re-referred back here, we'll, you know, if the committee decides to include it in the final bill, we'll have time. You can work with him on it. And I understand what you're saying. Maybe one of the approaches, you know, the other side of the aisle is kind of waking me up as to being a good capitalist. And, you know, maybe we got to look at the state getting a little piece of the pie when they invest in something like this. But we've got a lot of time to work on this, I think. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we can just talk about it later if we put it in our budget. Then, but the things that we're giving the tax credit for are high technology, and I'm just thinking there's a lot of ways for people to create jobs in Minnesota. And you know, we run a junkyard. If we were to open a junkyard, that creates jobs. So I just would want to work with the author on the definition to address areas of the economy we want to stimulate that aren't necessarily high technology.
And you bring up a very good point, and Representative Winkler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, in fact, I mean, the reason is we have, as you know, there's a limited amount of money for this kind of subsidy, and it's targeted at that part of the economy that is one of the driving factors for our underperformance with the rest of the country. So if we're looking at Minnesota's high personal income, high low unemployment kind of quality of the economy that we all are enjoying, I think we should try to focus our resources on the areas that are weakest rather than providing a general credit, which probably won't go very far.
I think, you know, Representative Winkler's language on page 2, line 2.19, probably opens it up to a junkyard even, because you're working on those high technologies. You know, you're getting all that copper and
for green manufacturing.
That's right. There you go.
Reverse manufacturing.
That's right. You are. Okay. We've got the motion in front of us. Representative Welty renews his motion. House File 3143 be recommended to pass, re-refer to taxes, and then come back here, Representative Winkler. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Both. Motion prevails. Representative Stolberg. Representative Stolberg has a witness here. Come on down if you want to, you know, just come down and help start it off. I think, did you find Representative Stolberg in the basement hearing room? There he is. It's like a blister. He shows up when the work's done. Representative Gunther moves that House File 3295 be recommended to pass, and I guess you've got to go on quite a journey with this. Are we going to judiciary next, or where are we going?
Local government, I would think.
Okay. Representative Gunther moves House File 3295 to recommend to pass and re-refer to local government.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. There is an amendment as well. Let's put that on right away.
Yes. Okay.
And we will only take it. While that's being passed out, why don't I have...
Go ahead with the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And remember, thanks for hearing this bill. This has brought to me the problem that exists, and I think throughout the state of Minnesota, for those that serve on economic development authority. That's what the conflict is into. And I have Ed Zabinski, who is a business person in Grand Rapids and serves on the EDA up there, very active EDA, who can probably explain the situation better than I ever could. And I think this legislation will address their concerns.
And the amendment itself, Representative Solberg, just...
It does some clarifying, I think. Okay. The Senate put it on today and we might have put it on here.
Representative Gunther then moves the SCS 2806A-1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The bill now is in the form. Mr. Spence, welcome to the committee. Nice
to see you. Good afternoon. Thank you very much, members of the committee and Chairman Rukavina, for the opportunity. My name is Ed Zabinski from Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to offer a very few words of support for this bill. As Representative Solberg indicated, I'm a member of the Grand Rapids Economic Development Authority. Actually, I've been the president of the group for the past 5 years. This bill is necessary, in our opinion, to attract and retain interested, committed volunteers to work on municipal EDAs. We're hoping with this legislation to provide flexibility throughout the state to help us manage conflicts of interest in the same manner in which HRAs manage their conflicts of interest. Let me just provide a couple of words of background about the Economic Development Authority in Grand Rapids. It consists of 7 members, 2 of whom are city councilors. We represent 2 people in the banking profession, an accountant, a social worker, a property manager, a realtor, and a retired business owner. The Grand Rapids City Council has a standard procedure for recruiting volunteers, but frankly, we consider it a moral victory if we ever attract even more than one person for these vacancies. The council appoints people with a demonstrated interest in the well-being of our community, but also with a passion for economic development. With roughly 8,000 residents in Grand Rapids, the candidate pool is admittedly limited. As passionate as my EDA colleagues and I may be about economic development, frankly, this topic doesn't excite everyone. We have to work hard to encourage good volunteers to step forward. We're not any different than any other community, frankly, in cultivating enthusiastic community volunteers, but being a member of the EDA is made more difficult by the rules that govern participation. We discovered last fall, to our chagrin, that what we thought was standard operating procedure, frankly, had the potential for resulting in a gross misdemeanor for several of our participants. We were assembling a loan fund so that we could expedite some economic development in downtown. And in the due diligence process, our attorneys discovered that the way we had been operating conflicts of interest, managing conflicts of interest, were in fact in conflict with state statutes. And one of our members is the manager of a store that installs and sells commercial windows, resigned once he learned that there would be a hint of perception of conflict of interest for him. So at that point, we contacted Senator Faxog and Representative Solberg, and we're here today to follow up on that.
So, I mean, it's just as simple as the guy's on your board and he has a window business and he might install a window in one of your projects, and now he can be charged with something.
Chairman Rukavina, that's right. And what happens with an HRA is the way we'd like to be governed. If you are a member of an HRA, or frankly even a city council member, you declare the potential conflict of interest, you abstain from discussion, you abstain from voting, the issue is debated, and then you resume participation. And frankly, that's our goal, is to have that same language govern the way we do business. You know, for an entity whose stated purpose is economic development and job growth, there are a lot of people with the right skill sets in the business community and elsewhere who would like to participate. What we want for a small town like Grand Rapids is the opportunity to expand that pool of resources. The most valuable resource, I suppose, we have is people. And we'd like to use as many of the people who are willing to step forward as we can.
Well, I think most of this committee would think what you have in front of us, Representative Solberg, is pretty reasonable. If Representative McFarland, Gunther, and I, and Poppy can agree on this, right? I think it's pretty reasonable. Any questions on the bill? Representative Clark.
understand that sounds like a good idea. When you were talking about someone having a conflict of interest, what if their conflict of interest isn't direct, but it's indirect, and it's maybe creating a competition to something that they do have an interest in? Is that covered in here?
Chairman Rukavina, Representative Clark, I believe it is. And I think we had to have people resign because we've been appointed without realizing the full extent of this statute. And if the city council had been aware of this, I suspect that individual and several of the rest of us would never have been appointed because of the kinds of businesses we're in. Yes.
And I think that as we pick up the same language as in the HRA, say the conflict of interest, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, if there is a conflict of interest and you abstain from it, but it's also if you, and as we do in the legislature, if we're not affected any different than our class, you know, there's no conflict of interest. I mean, as a teacher, I could vote on education bills because I was no more confident than the whole class. But in this particular case, where the way the law is for EDAs, a guy in this particular case, he would potentially sell a window to a business that was having a loan through the EDA, and that became a potential conflict of interest for him, and he probably never even knew it. You know.
It seems pretty reasonable.
It really does, I think.
Okay, for the motion, then Representative Gunter removes this motion at House File 3295 be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Local and Government Affairs Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We'll try to get one more bill, Representative Hortman.
Thank you for allowing it.
Thank you both very much. Representative Hortman and I got to apologize again to the department. This isn't intentional. We've been going over at the session, and then my members are, you know, moving in late. I can't call a meeting order, and I apologize, and tomorrow you're first on the agenda. No excuses unless session quote. We've heard this bill before. Representative Hortman moves 3707 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Ms. Samarja, welcome to the committee. Members, for your information, this was passed last year in our bill and vetoed, line item vetoed by the governor. So, Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you gave that background. I just wanted the committee members to know I'm not introducing, I don't think I've had any bills that have gone to hearing that spend money considering our deficit situation, but this is a unique case since the governor and line item vetoed this out of our bill. But James Samarja will give you a little bit of background to remind us what we heard last year.
Ms. Marjorie, I think most of us remember hired and the good things you do, so if you can be brief, we got to be out of here. We're supposed to be out of here 5 minutes ago. Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Rokodina, Representative Portman. I am Executive Director of Hired, a nonprofit that runs workforce development programs, and I'm here again this year to ask for an appropriation to support Hired industry sector initiatives. The appropriation would support the development and coordination of new sector initiatives and the training of low-income people for high-demand jobs. Just to briefly explain, sector initiatives are leading-edge strategies for preparing low-income workers for jobs in industry groups. That is why they're called sector initiatives. And these are groups that need highly skilled workers trained to their specifications. So this is not to be confused with customized training for one company. Sector initiatives are collaborative, and they provide a package of services that is employer-driven and is overseen by employer advisory councils. I'll give you one very short example of this. Our Empowered program prepares people for manufacturing careers. It produces a return on investment of, we've calculated, at least $38 per individual per dollar invested. And we take these programs into the prisons as well. And for people coming out of prisons and getting jobs with our member companies, the return on investment is $78 per hour. We have been recognized by the the National Association of Manufacturers and the National Governors Association Center for Best Practices for our work in this area. And I'd also like to say that we've had cooperation from many of the staff at BEAD working with us, advising us, working with us on funding, specifically for training and so forth. And so we feel that this is a well-accepted program. The functions that HIRED provides are really too numerous to name in the time allotted here. As one advisory council member put it, HIRED is the glue that holds the collaboration together. And the collaboration is of many employers, the technical colleges, adult basic education, and we staff and work with all those entities to make this work, the prison systems, Department of Labor and Industry. It's a very time-consuming job to hold together a number of small businesses, work with small businesses who are very busy. The owners typically wear many hats, and so we come in and wear other hats for them. And traditional funding does not fund those functions. So we've been very successful. We have many other plans that we would like to move forward, and that is what this appropriation would support. I provided you with some information. There's a great deal of detail there, but I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions? Representative Gunther. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the future of Minnesota needing more and more trained workers, and the ability for us to grow and prosper is going to be dependent upon that, I can't think of an organization that would take people that come out of prison and train them in how to be a productive citizen of Minnesota. I think this is a wonderful program.
If you recall, members, we had a young lady that told us her story and how she was in jail, and they took her out, or they took her in, and she was, I think, a sheet metal worker, or ended up being a
metal stamping.
Metal stamping, yeah. So they've been very successful. With that, then, Representative Hartman renews her motion.
Right. Mr. Chair, can I just ask real quick, do you know, did the governor tell us why he vetoed this? Do you remember how many components of our budget he vetoed? This isn't a pretty special
category. And I don't think he ever gave us the reason. I suspect he thought there were other programs that could serve it, I guess.
Representative Rocavina, I believe that the line item veto did say that perhaps we could seek funding from other sources, perhaps including the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership. You'll see on your fact sheet there that our collaborative does have funding from the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership for curriculum development, for those kinds of things that the Job Skills Partnership funds. For the essential functions that we provide as a workforce intermediary, convening all these players, bringing together all the resources, staffing by advisory council, reporting, helping with grant writing, case managing the participants so that they don't interrupt their training, they don't lose their job. There is practically no funding for that, and that's what this is for.
Okay, Representative Hartman then renews her motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much. Members, meeting adjourned, and tomorrow I hope we do have, because we have floor session at what time? 9:30, and the bonding bill, maybe we won't be meeting again tomorrow, but if for the folks from Deeds, stay tuned, I guess.